and welcome to the 2014 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, An American Christmas, a sampling of history, stories, and poems that are all American. We'll hear the history of Christmas trees for sale from the Christmas Tree Book by Philip V. Snyder, published by Penguin Books in 1977. A selection from Once Upon a Christmas by Pearl S. Buck, published by the John Day Company in 1972. Legends of Christmas Tree Ornaments from Christmas Ornament Legends, published by Old World Christmas in 1995, and two cowboy Christmas poems from Christmas Out West, published by Doubleday in 1990. I'm your host, Jim Seitz. Let's begin our show with Christmas Trees for Sale from the Christmas Tree Book by Philip V. Snyder.
Round and round the Christmas tree, presents hanging there for you and me. Lights all shining merrily, Christmas a week away.
Early each December, bundles of some 40 million Christmas trees materialize under strings of bare light bulbs on street corners and vacant lots across America. The story of how trees became a part of the American Christmas is made up of a series of small beginnings. Until the middle of the 19th century, any family who had a Christmas tree either cut it themselves or ordered it from a farmer. The custom was mostly practiced by first or second generation German Americans, although Americans of other stock had probably begun to hear about the German trees or had even seen them for themselves, since they are known to have been on sale in Philadelphia markets in 1848. In 1851, 80 miles north of New York City in the Catskill Mountains on the far side of the Hudson, a man named Mark Carr had the idea of starting that city's first Christmas tree business. Carr knew there were a lot of German families in New York. Since the trees were free for the taking around his home, and the cost of transporting them would be his only out-of-pocket expense, he decided he had a good deal to gain and little to lose by trying to sell them. Carr broached the idea to his family, and although his wife was less than enthusiastic, his sons offered to help him cut the trees. One day in mid-December, they loaded two ox sleds with young firs and spruces and drove at a lumbering slow-motion speed over the rough roads to the Hudson River at the village of Catskill Landing. Here they loaded the trees onto a steamboat, and Mark Carr proceeded alone with them to New York's Washington Market. Washington Market had been New York's wholesale food and vegetable market for 100 years. It had been selling a large variety of Christmas greens brought down from the Catskills and over from New Jersey. But until now, nobody had thought to sell Christmas trees. According to a Moore family story on December 23, 1822, during a moonlight sleigh ride home from this same Washington Market, where he had gone to buy a turkey, Clement C. Moore conceived the idea for A Visit from St. Nicholas. He went to his study and wrote the poem, which he read to his six children the following evening. A silver dollar secured for Carr the rent of a small strip of sidewalk on the busy corner of Greenwich and Vesey Streets, where he set up his trees. What happened was reported in an 1895 article in New England Magazine. Quick and certain was his success, exceeding his fondest expectations. Eagerly, customers flocked to purchase the mountain novelties at what appeared to the unsophisticated countryman very exorbitant prices. It did not take long to exhaust the entire stock, and then, highly elated, Mark enjoyed a few days of city life before returning home to gladden the hearts of his boys with the result of their venture, and it may be to crow a little over Dame Carr. The following year, he returned with more trees. that original corner became the center of a burgeoning tree market, which spread outward from the old market until, by the 1880s, with more than 600 tree dealers competing for space, 30-some had to rent from the city additional space along the adjacent dockfront. We do not know exactly how Mark Carr earned his living the other 11 months of the year. The New York Times described him as a jolly woodman, which could have referred to any of the wood-related trades that were the primary industry of the Catskill Mountains. In those days, the area was studded with tiny sawmills and furniture factories run by water power supplied by mountain streams. Since these streams froze each year from December until March, December was the beginning of a slow season for Mark Carr and his fellow woodmen, so that Christmas trees became an ideal part-time job. Mark Carr remained in the business for many years, and in 1898, one of his sons was still taking trees down to New York. Seeking an advantage against competition, the men from the Catskills always proclaimed that their trees were the only fresh-cut ones. They were quick to insist that trees from Massachusetts or New Hampshire or New York's Adirondacks had to be cut so early that they were drying by the time they got to the New York market. They would grab a branch and shake it vigorously to prove their needles would not fall off. This kind of demonstration was important in the days of wax candles and the ever-present fear of Christmas tree fires. Before many years passed, however, the Catskill Mountain men could supply only a fraction of the trees required by the market each year. Reforestation had not yet been thought of, and it became increasingly difficult to find enough good trees in Rip Van Winkle's mountains. Every succeeding Christmas found the men transporting their trees longer distances from remote parts of the Catskills. By 1880, a veritable forest of 200,000 trees was moving to Washington Market from all over the Northeast. They came on boats, by trains, and in big horse-drawn farm wagons, some with a swaying second deck added so they could carry more trees. From about December 10th until Christmas, the competition between dealers and between the dealers and uptown wholesalers who would sell trees to the neighborhood grocers, druggists, and fishmongers was as sharp as in any of the more established mercantile exchanges of the city. But not everybody around Washington Market was concerned with making money. On nice December days, the tree market was reported to be a favorite spot for loungers. They came to lie around on the soft boughs and inhale the overwhelmingly fragrant balsam scent of the thousands upon thousands of new cut trees. The trees were piled up like cordwood in huge piles twice as tall as a man, or they stood on butt ends in long rows for several blocks inland from the waterfront. Sidewalks were walled in behind hills of trees that excluded the sunlight, compelling the storekeepers in adjacent stores to use gas lights even at midday. The merchants were richly rewarded for this annual inconvenience, for by 1870 some were already exacting as much as $100 for the rental of even a relatively small space for 10 days. Many of the Christmas trees that came down the river on various types of sailing ships stayed on board, where a temporary market was established on deck. Each year, a few 40-foot trees rose above the eaves of the ferry house, as tall as the masts of the steamboats and schooners that brought them down the river. The largest trees would soon be found bending under the weight of fruit and presents in the lecture rooms of Sunday schools, missions, and German clubs and societies. The big saloons in the German sections of the city and Brooklyn took most of the 20-foot trees. The American Sunday School Society deserves much of the credit for popularizing the Christmas tree. Sunday schools adopted the custom long before most families had trees, and several generations of Americans knew Christmas trees only at church. We'll return with the continuation of Christmas Trees for Sale, but now let's focus on how our current traditions and customs came from the old world into the new world and helped create our American Christmas. Nutcrackers were traditionally dressed as soldiers and kings. In old Germany, it delighted villagers to see these authoritarian figures doing menial tasks such as cracking nuts. A bowl of Christmas nuts was just not complete without a colorful German nutcracker standing at attention nearby. Nutcrackers were especially popular with Germans who coined the phrase, "God gives the nuts, but we have to crack them ourselves," which was intended to teach children that life was hard but rewarding. This phrase made the nutcracker a favorite toy, possibly because it enabled children to reach life's rewards more easily. Let's now journey out west and listen to A Cowboy's Christmas Prayer. I ain't much good at praying, and you may not know me, Lord. I ain't much seen in churches where they preach thy holy word. But you may have observed me out here on the lonely plains, looking after cattle, feeling thankful when it rains. Admiring thy great handiwork, the miracle of grass, aware of thy kind spirit in the way it comes to pass, that hired men on horseback and the livestock that we tend can look up at the stars at night and know we've got a friend. So here's old Christmas coming on, reminding us again of him whose coming brought goodwill into the hearts of men. A cowboy ain't no preacher, Lord, but if you'll hear my prayer, I'll ask as good as we have got for all men everywhere. Don't let no hearts be bitter, Lord. Don't let no child be cold. Make easy beds for them that's sick and them that's weak and old. Let kindness bless the trail we ride, no matter what we're after, and sorter keep us on your side in tears as well as laughter. I've seen old cows a-starvin', and it ain't no happy sight. Please, don't leave no one hungry, Lord, on thy good Christmas night. No man, no child, no woman, and no critter on 4 feet. I'll aim to do my best to help you find him chuck to eat. I'm just a sinful cowpoke, Lord. Ain't got no business praying, but still I hope you'll catch a word or two of what I'm saying. We speak of Merry Christmas, Lord. I reckon you'll agree there ain't no Merry Christmas for nobody that ain't free. So one more thing I'll ask you, Lord. Just help us what you can to save some seeds of freedom for the future sons of man. You're listening to the 2014 Sight Into Sound Christmas Special, An American Christmas. I'm Jim Seitz. In the new world, we call him Santa Claus, but in the old world, he was originally known as Saint Nicholas. And according to legend, he was a kind, benevolent man, legendary for performing miracles, and later became the patron saint of children. St. Nicholas was the European equivalent of the American Santa Claus. He was a thin figure clothed in bishop's robes who rode into town on a white horse on St. Nicholas Day, December 6th. The holiday season began on this day in Europe, and St. Nicholas Eve was a night to which children everywhere looked forward with eager anticipation. On this widely celebrated holiday, parents instructed their children to leave their shoes by the door in hopes that St. Nicholas would fill them with treats. Good boys and girls often received fruit, nuts, and candy, but bad boys and girls found nothing but a rod, switch, or lump of coal. It is thought that the giving of gifts to small children during the Christmas holiday originated directly from the legend of their patron saint, St. Nicholas. Holiday gift-giving was first observed in France during the Middle Ages, when nuns would leave charitable gifts for the poor and needy on the eve of St. Nicholas Day, in his honor. The practice of bestowing gifts on children on December 6th quickly spread throughout Europe. and the night of December 5th was often celebrated with parades, festivities, and merriment of all kinds. Today, families in Europe continue to commence the celebration of the Christmas holidays on St. Nicholas Eve, December 5th, and often attend a midnight mass. The legend of St. Nicholas and his kind generosity has endured to this day, and the benevolence he represents is a permanent part of the magic of the holidays. Let's return now to the continuation of Christmas Trees for Sale. Different years saw different styles in trees. Cedar trees were popular in the 1860s, but by 1880 the fashion had switched to evergreens that did not dry as fast and create so great a fire hazard when lighted with candles. A number of old accounts and early photographs of Christmas trees show hemlocks. Their use, however, was relatively small because the ends of their branches were too lacy and frail to support many types of ornamentation adequately. Up in Maine, balsam firs had always been considered a nuisance because they grew like weeds. A new interest in them for Christmas trees proved very fortunate for hundreds of Maine's rural people as well as for the railroads. The tree's popularity began in 1892, when a steam yacht returning to Boston from Newfoundland called at Sargentville on Penobscot Bay. The beauty of the firs attracted the attention of the owner of the yacht, who took 500 young trees to Boston and sold them at good prices in Boston's Christmas market at Faneuil Hall. Up to that time, pines, cedars, and spruces had been commonly used as Christmas trees, but within a few years of the Boston yachtman's speculation, balsam became New England's favorite. A decade later, about 1.5 million trees were shipped annually from Maine. Men, women, and children worked together in the Christmas tree harvest, and in some localities, the cutting of the trees was made the occasion of a general merrymaking, like the husking bees and other farm festivals of the period. The trees were bundled up according to size in lots of 6 or 12 and conveyed on hay racks to the railroad station, where they were either sold to traveling buyers or shipped directly to Boston or New York. The farmers got about 5 cents for each of the smaller trees, 10 to 15 cents for those 8 to 10 feet tall. In all, Maine people realized about $150,000 a year from their Christmas greens, which was a lot of money for the state in 1900. By 1893, the demand for trees in New York City finally outstripped the supply, and prices were unnaturally high, which created new problems. In 1895, a reporter found a little colony of mountaineers from the Catskills in some confusion over the very important question of selecting a watchman for the night. "Do they steal our trees?" retorted one man in reply to the reporter's question. "Well, now, I should say they do. Just ask Wiltsy. He and Fromer have been coming down here for 10 years. Do they steal trees? Well, maybe." In Washington, D.C., Center Market, the great food supply depot, was the place to get a Christmas tree. Throughout the week before Christmas, huge wagon loads of evergreens and holly would arrive from Virginia, West Virginia, and Maryland. It was reported that in the 1880s, most of the evergreens were offered for sale by country blacks who sold their own homemade stands. The stand consisted of a large square pine base, around which was erected a picket fence about 8 inches high. In the center of the base was a socket for the tree's trunk. The pickets were painted white with red, green, or yellow trim. Washington Society, which went en masse to the market for their trees, was said to have fought shy of these gaudy contrivances, which they said resembled nothing so much as a southern prison stockade in miniature. In cities like Washington, Philadelphia, and New York at the turn of the 20th century, trees that hadn't been sold by neighborhood grocers and florists on Christmas Eve were never wasted. On Christmas morning, the poor would set forth to buy a tree for 10 or 15 cents, although there were those to whom even this was a prohibitive price. They would wait for their tree perhaps until the day after Christmas, or the middle of the week, or even New Year's Day. Mothers told their waiting children that Santa Claus was certainly coming. He had merely been delayed a few days, having so many children to visit. But he would surely come. Finally, they would secure a tree, perhaps for 5 cents. By New Year's Day, there was scarcely a tree to be seen. In the Midwest in the 1880s, Christmas trees for cities like Chicago came largely by boat from the forest of Michigan. One family became a legend in Chicago's past as a result of the unique hardships of that trade. As early as 1887, two brothers named Schuneman sailed down from Manistique, Michigan in their fishing schooner with a load of trees they had cut lashed to the deck. They tied up beside Chicago's Clark Street Bridge and began to sell their trees. In 1898, the elder brother, August Schuneman, with his boatload of trees, was lost in a December storm. Lake Michigan can be as rough as the ocean in a winter storm. But year after year, the younger brother, Herman, continued to tie up at the same location and is said to have sold all his trees before anyone else. Everyone who ever met Herman Schuneman seemed to like him, remember him, and become a regular customer of The Captain. One year, Herman brought his new bride with him, and the following year and every year thereafter, he proudly told his regular customers about his wife and baby daughter Elsie, and a few years later about his twin daughters Pearl and Hazel. In mid-November of 1912, Herman and his crew cut a load of trees in the icy forest outside Manistique and started for Chicago. Like his brother, he too got caught in a Lake Michigan winter storm. His boat, the Rouse Simmons, with its crew of 17, was last seen off Two Rivers, Wisconsin, on November 23rd. When the captain was reported missing, the Chicago newspapers and the Midwest raised an outcry. Ships were taken off regular runs, private yachts set out, and prominent men persuaded Uncle Sam to lend revenue cutters to join the search. Eventually, it became clear the Christmas tree ship would never be seen again. In 1913, Herman's widow took over his business, and she brought a ship to Chicago each year for many years thereafter. Schuneman Christmas tree ships were therefore part of Chicago history for 47 years. On the Atlantic coast, evergreens for Christmas trees were being cut at a greater rate than ever. Credit for the first Christmas tree farm in the country goes to a New Jersey man named McGalliard. This is his son's account. In the spring of 1901, my father, the late W.V. McGalliard, planted some 25,000 Norway spruce on our homestead farm in Mercer County, just outside Trenton. These trees were obtained from Charles Black, a nurseryman in Hightstown, New Jersey, and were, I believe, imported from the Scandinavian countries. 20,000 of them were 8 to 14-inch transplants, and the remaining 5,000 were seedlings. Since I was 6 years of age at the time, the event naturally made quite an impression on me. It is my recollection that the trees came packed in moss in a large wooden piano shipping case. They were planted every 4 feet and cultivated as long as it was feasible. The circumstances which induced my father to go into this venture are interesting. While I think that Mr. Black, the nurseryman, may have suggested the possibilities originally, the fact that we had a 10-acre gravelly field on which it had become impossible to grow a profitable farm crop had much to do with it. Noting that a Norway spruce hedge along the road in front of the farm grew about as well on poor soil as on good, my father put two and two together and figured that Christmas trees might be a good gamble on the 10 acres which had been such a problem. The excellent market at Trenton, only 4 or 5 miles away, was no small factor also. When the trees were ready for market in 1907 or 1908, as I recall it, A flat price of $1 each was established. The customer would make a selection in the field, and the tree would be sawed off for him to take along. Many customers preferred to tag their trees weeks in advance for delivery at Christmas. Delivery was made by loading 50 or more trees on a farm wagon drawn by a team of horses and driving the 4 or 5 miles into Trenton. The $1 price was maintained for many years thereafter. After the original crop was harvested, several other plantings were made by my father and later my brother. All were Norway spruce, there being no demand for other varieties. We'll continue with Christmas trees for sale at the end of the show, but first let's explore how the star on the top of our tree became a beacon of hope. Star ornaments originated as a symbol of guidance and faith, representing the Star of Bethlehem, which led the Magi to the manger where Christ was born. Brilliant stars are frequently placed above a creche or atop the Christmas tree as part of cherished family traditions. German glassblowers have created star ornaments for centuries as dazzling reminders of the significant role stars have played in Christmas traditions, representing the true magic of the heavens. You're listening to the 2014 Sight into Sound Christmas special, An American Christmas. I'm Jim Seitz. Now let's read a selection from Once Upon a Christmas and explore the wonders of a 6-year-old boy's imagination as he encounters the Christmas ghost. "Where shall we put the big star?" Jimsy asked. Jimsy was 6 years old. His real name was James Collingswood Brown, but he was called Jimsy because his mother had said one day when she was trying to button his coat, "Oh, please stand still, Jimmy. You're such a Jimsy, Jumpsy little boy." And from that day on, he was called Jimsy. The star was almost as tall as he was. "Let's have a big star," his mother had said last week. "A big star to celebrate this first Christmas in our own home." The house was one they had chosen together, a farmhouse set in meadows, and they moved there in the autumn when the trees were red and gold and already it was home. They had lived in the city before they found the house, but Jimsy's father said a boy should grow up in the country, where there was plenty of room, and that was why they were here instead of there. Now it was Christmas Eve, and Jimsy's father had just finished the star. It was made of 5 crossed pieces of wood, and on each piece of wood he had fastened electric lights. They stood around it to admire it, Jimsy, his father, his mother, and Mr. Higgins, the hired man. Mr. Higgins was old and bent over, but he had been Jimsy's best friend ever since they had moved into the house in the country. "Yes, it's such a big star. Where shall we put it?" Jimsy's mother asked. "Let's think," Jimsy's father said. "Put it at the top of the big sycamore tree there by the front door," Mr. Higgins said. "Then the lights will shine clear down to the bridge." "A good idea," Jimsy's father said. "That's what we'll do." The house stood on a hill, and at the bottom of the hill was a brook, and across the brook was a bridge. Jimsy could see the bridge very easily now as he jumped around the tree. It had 3 arches, and it was made of stone, a pretty bridge, his mother said, and it was another reason she had wanted to buy this particular house. Meanwhile, the star was going up. First, Mr. Higgins tied a rope around the middle of the star, then he fetched a ladder and set it against the tree, then he climbed up into the tree, and Jimsy's father lifted the star, and Mr. Higgins pulled until the star was high among the branches facing the bridge. "Beautiful," Jimsy's mother said. Mr. Higgins tied the star fast to a branch, and then he climbed down carefully because he was quite old. And Jimsy's father went into the house to attach the electric cord. In a moment, the star was shining, and they all clapped their hands, and Jimsy's mother sang, "O little star of Bethlehem." Except this is a big star, Jimsy said when she had finished.
Quite right, his father said. And now I must go about some Christmas business of my own.
So must I, Jimsy's mother said. That left just Jimsy and Mr. Higgins, and as usual, they began to talk. That is, Mr. Higgins began to talk, and Jimsy listened. Mr. Higgins loved to talk, and Jimsy liked to hear him, and so everything was all right. Mr. Higgins began,
"You see the big barn, Jimsy?"
"I see it," Jimsy said. It was easy to see, because there it stood, not far from the house, a huge red barn with a slanting roof. It was made of stone and wood, and inside the big doors were piles of hay and straw.
"You see the bridge?"
Mr. Higgins asked.
"I see the bridge," Jimsy said.
He could not see it too well now, for the sun was beginning to set, and a faint mist was rising from the brook. Still, he could see the three arches and the curve over the water.
"Did you know that a ghost walks betwixt the barn and the bridge at midnight of every Christmas Eve?"
"A ghost?" Jimsy repeated in a small voice.
"A ghost," Mr. Higgins said firmly. "It's the ghost of my old friend Timothy Stillwagon, who died several years ago, come the day after Christmas."
"Why does his ghost stay in our barn?" Jimsy asked. He was not sure that he liked the idea of a ghost, especially on Christmas Eve and in his barn.
"It wasn't your barn in those days," Mr. Higgins said. "It was the barn of Timothy Stillwagon himself. He was the farmer here, and he lived in the house here, and he kept his cows in the barn here, and every Christmas Eve the two of us would walk together from the barn down to the bridge at midnight, mind you, after he'd trimmed the tree for his children. I'd trim the tree for my children, too, and my wife and me, and then I'd walk up to the hill to see his tree, and he'd walk back down with me to see my tree, because my house is there by the bridge."
It was true that Mr. Higgins' house was there by the bridge. It was a small house set in a small, neat garden.
"Why did you walk to see your trees?" Jimsy asked.
"Because," Mr. Higgins said, "whichever of the two of us had the finer tree, the other was supposed to buy him a cup of hot coffee at the village diner."
"Did you have the best tree, Mr. Higgins?" Jimsy asked.
Mr. Higgins laughed in big chuckles.
"Neither one nor the other of us ever got that cup of coffee, on account of we always thought each had the prettier tree. The end of that was that we'd walk back and forth betwixt the barn and the bridge arguing about it until we couldn't walk no more on account of the cold. And you'll be getting cold too, Jimsy, just standing here listening to me talk about it. So go into the house before your mother calls you in."
"Good night, Mr. Higgins," Jimsy said, "and I wish you a Merry Christmas."
"The same to you, Jimsy," Mr. Higgins said. "And it will be a Merry Christmas for me because you are here. My own children are grown up and gone away. My old wife is dead, and I'm alone yonder in that little house of mine by the bridge, as I've been for many a year. But this Christmas, bless you, when I look up there, I won't see a dark house. I'll see a warm house with a family in it, and you the child, and above the house a big star shining. Old Timothy Stillwagon and I will have something to talk about at last."
Jimsy was surprised.
"You mean you still talk to him?"
"Oh, sure," Mr. Higgins said cheerfully. "Him and me, we walked the road together just as we always did on Christmas Eve. Me and my flesh and bones, and he and his ghost."
Jimmy heard this, and he was not at all sure he liked the idea of a ghost walking this very night of Christmas Eve. He went into the house and shut the door tightly and ran to find his mother. She was in the living room tying silver balls on the Christmas tree.
"Mother," he said in a little voice, "I'm here."
She turned around surprised.
"Why, Jimsy," she said, "you look white. Are you cold?"
"No," Jimsy said. "It's just that Mr. Higgins says we have a ghost."
"Do we?" she said. "Well now, who is he?"
"He's a man who used to live here, Mr. Higgins says, but now he's a ghost." His mother laughed.
"Oh, that Mr. Higgins, he does talk so much. Don't you believe him, Mother?"
"Not when he talks about ghosts," she said, and she tied another silver ball on the tree. At this moment, from upstairs, Jimsy heard his father singing a Christmas carol. It was his favorite, a cheerful one, the one about decking halls with boughs of holly, and Jimsy ran upstairs.
"Daddy," he said all out of breath, "did you know we have a ghost?"
His father was tying a red ribbon around a very small box wrapped in silver paper. "Tell me about it," he said. Jimsy began all over again.
"It's the ghost of Mr. Timothy Stillwagon. He lived in this house, him and his children."
"He and his children," his father said. "And I'm sure they had a happy life, and bless his ghost. And don't tell your mother you saw me wrapping this very small package, because it's for her. And inside it is a beautiful gold bracelet made just for her."
"I won't tell," Jimsy said, and he stood watching his father tie a big bow on the small box. "Are you afraid of ghosts, Daddy?"
he said after a while. "Well," his father said, "I've never seen one." "It's silly to be afraid of something you've never seen. Fact is, Jimsy, I don't even believe in ghosts."
"Mr. Higgins does," Jimsy said.
"Well, he's a lonely old man, and maybe he dreams of ghosts to keep him company. And speaking of company, let's go downstairs and see if your mother needs help with the tree." They went downstairs together, and what with one thing and another, eating supper by the fire and having his bath and hanging up his stocking by the chimney-piece, Jimsy went to sleep thinking about Santa Claus instead of Timothy Stillwagon.
"Go to sleep right away," his mother said when she tucked him into bed.
"Santa Claus has a lot to do for you tonight," his father said, kissing him good night. How long he slept, Jimsy did not know. When he woke up, the house was very quiet. So quiet that he thought he would get up and see why it was quiet. He put on his slippers and his warm red bathrobe and went to the window. The big star was still shining so that Santa Claus could find his way, and shining so brightly that Jimsy could almost see the bridge. Then suddenly he saw the ghost. Slowly, slowly, he saw a small figure walk out of the barn and down the road toward the bridge. He stared as hard as he could. Was it really? Yes, it really was a ghost, a shadowy gray ghost in the light of the star. For a minute, Jimsy wanted to run back to bed and pull the covers over his head. Then he remembered what his father had said. "It's silly to be afraid of something you've never seen." And instead of hiding himself in bed, Jimsy decided then and there that he would go and look at the ghost and see whether he was to be afraid of it. It took several minutes to get into his clothes and his warm coat and his galoshes, for there was snow on the ground, but he managed. He slipped out the front door, and he was glad the big star was shining across the meadow and on the road so that he did not need a lantern from the barn. He ran as fast as he could down the road looking for the ghost. He couldn't see it. He couldn't see anybody or anything, just the snowy white road lit by the star. Now he was almost disappointed. To be so near a ghost and then lose it. He stopped running and wondered whether he should just go home and back to bed. He was not afraid, oh no, but everything was so quiet, and beyond the edge of the light from the star was the darkness. But Jimsy was quite a brave boy at heart, and he did not give up easily, and soon he began to walk again toward the bridge. It was a good thing that he did, for now he saw the ghost again. It was sitting on the wall of the bridge, and it looked very small and tired and lonely. He was suddenly not afraid anymore. He began to walk briskly until he reached the bridge. Then he stopped and looked at the ghost. The light from the star was dim now, for the bridge was rather far from the house, and he could not see the ghost very well. He stepped nearer and nearer until he was quite close. Yes, there the ghost was, sitting on the stone wall of the bridge. Now at this very minute, what should happen except a big sneeze? Jimsy had forgotten to put on his cap, and the cold wind was blowing around his ears and in his hair. At the sound of the sneeze, the ghost gave a start.
"Why, Jimsy," it said, "what are you doing here at this time of night?"
The voice was not the voice of a ghost. Not at all. It was the voice of Mr. Higgins. The wind blew off the ghost's hat, and under it was the face of Mr. Higgins, looking very cold and wrinkled.
"I wanted to see a ghost," Jimsy said, "and it's only you, Mr. Higgins. Isn't there any ghost? You shouldn't have said there was a ghost when it's only you, Mr. Higgins."
"Well now, Jimsy," Mr. Higgins said, "I'm ashamed I said there was a real ghost when it's only Timothy Stillwagon's memory that I walk with on Christmas Eve. I guess I wanted to believe he walks with me every Christmas. Of course he can't walk in flesh and blood the way he used to, and so I just made him into a ghost, because even his ghost would be more than nothing at all, you know? Yes, I guess it's only a memory I walk with after all."
"What's a memory, Mr. Higgins?" Jimsy asked. Mr. Higgins picked up his cap and pushed it down over his ears. "It's something or somebody you can't ever forget." "Like the gray poodle dog we had," Jimsy said. "He got sick and died when we were living in the city, but I don't forget him. His name was Buster. Is he a memory, Mr. Higgins?"
"Sure he is," Mr. Higgins said. "The same as Timothy Stillwagon. We were friends all our lives, him and me. We went fishing together when we were little boys like you. We fished under this ferry bridge and caught catfish and took 'em home for supper. And we grew up and got married and had other little boys like you. And then one day it was all over, and only me left. Me and a memory. Timothy's not dead for me, Jimsy. Come Christmas Eve, I walk the road from the barn to the bridge, and he walks with me as if he was alive again. Call him a ghost or not, I see him this minute as he was alive because we were friends. As long as you remember somebody, he's still alive, and you if nowhere else, eh, Tim, old boy?"
Mr. Higgins turned his head and smiled, exactly as if Timothy Stillwagon were sitting there on the wall beside him.
"Do you see him?" Jimsy asked.
"I see him," Mr. Higgins said, "but that's because I know how he looked. You can't see him because you don't know how he looked."
"You're not afraid?" Jimsy asked.
"Of course not," Mr. Higgins said. "Do you think I could be afraid of Timothy? I never was, nor am I now. As long as I live, we're the same friends we always were."
"But when you die, Mr. Higgins?" Jimsy asked.
"Then you'll remember me come Christmas Eve," Mr. Higgins said, "seeing as we're getting to be such good friends already. Christmas Eve is a great time for remembering friends. Not just presents, you know, but thoughts. Loving thoughts."
"I'll always remember you, Mr. Higgins," Jimsy said.
"Good," Mr. Higgins said. "I'd rather have that for Christmas than a barrel full of presents."
He got up.
"That wall is sitting kind of cold under me, and you ought to be in bed. I'll take you back to the house. You understand what I've been talking about, Jimsy?"
"Kind of," Jimsy said.
"It'll come clear to you someday," Mr. Higgins said.
He took Jimsy's hand and they walked up the hill again in the steady light of the big star. And when they came to the house, Mr. Higgins said good night and Merry Christmas again, and Jimsy said the same to him. Then Jimsy went upstairs and put on his pajamas. Just before he jumped into bed, he looked out the window and saw Mr. Higgins, very small and bent, walking down the road to the bridge.
"So now," Jimsy told himself, "some Christmas Eve, when I'm as big as Daddy, maybe I'll look out this window and see the ghost of Mr. Higgins walking down that road. Only it won't be a ghost. It'll be my memory of Mr. Higgins."
He climbed into bed and pulled up the covers. Tomorrow he would have to explain to his father and mother. Explain the Christmas ghost. Tomorrow. Tomorrow. And suddenly he was fast asleep. Let's take another trip out west and listen to the cowboy poem, A Bunkhouse Christmas. "'Twas Christmas Eve out on the ranch, and all the winter crew was settin' round the bunkhouse fire with nothing else to do but let their fancies wander on the thoughts of Christmas Chuck, and what they'd like the best to eat if just they had the luck to set down to a table where the feast was laid so thick that all they'd have to do was reach to take their choice and pick. Young Sleepy Kid, the wrangler, claims he'd love a stomach ache from stuffing steady half a day on chocolate frosted cake. A slab of turkey breast, smacks Pete, and good old pumpkin pie. I'd reach for oyster dressing, Lobo Luther heaves a sigh. It ain't no Christmas feed for me, says little Charlie Moss, without brown turkey gravy and some red cranberry sauce. It's pie, avers old Swaller Fork, the kind my ma could make. It beats your pumpkin 40 ways, and also chocolate cake. So each they named their fancy till their chops began to drip. Then old Pop Williams gives a snort and rubs his crippled hip. He hitches to the window, sorter sizing up the night. Well, boys, he says, it's Christmas Eve, and if I figure right, that snow's too deep for travel, so before I hit the hay, upon the subject now in hand, I'll have my little say. It ain't what's in your stomach that's the most important part. It's the feeling of your gizzard, or in other words, your heart. Do another's kindness is the road to Christmas cheer, but that, of course, ain't possible the way we're snowbound here. It looks like all that we can do for our good Christmas deed is hustle all the livestock in and give them extra feed. To hungry cows, an extra fork of hay will seem as nice as when a hungry cowboy finds a raisin in his rice. And as for favorite Christmas chuck, I'll name mine now to wit. It's beef and beans and biscuits, 'cause I know that's what we'll get.
Bells rang throughout the world when Christ was born, according to early legend. Traditionally, bells have been used throughout Europe and America to ring in the Christmas season. The ringing of bells during the holiday season provides a joyful accompaniment to the festive singing of favorite carols. Bells have come to represent a vital part of Christmas celebration as church bells and sleigh bells brighten winter days with their joyous tinkle. Bell ornaments symbolize the joy and merriment of the Christmas holidays and are a welcome addition to Christmas traditions. Let's end the 2014 Christmas special with the conclusion of Christmas Trees for Sale. The indiscriminate cutting of forest evergreens for Christmas had been alarming naturalists and conservationists since the 1880s, but suddenly in 1901, America had a conservationist in the White House. Franklin Pierce introduced a Christmas tree to the presidential mansion in 1856, and it had become an established tradition by the 1880s. But when reporters asked Theodore Roosevelt how he would decorate his White House Christmas tree, he declared there would be none. Today, many think ecology was discovered in the 1960s, but in reality, we had just forgotten what a lot of people had known as the 20th century came in. By 1900, our natural resources had been surprisingly depleted. Roughly one half of all the timber in the United States had been cut. Topsoil was washing away, and many of our native birds and mammals were already approaching extinction. Roosevelt was a conservationist by both instinct and by training. He believed the rate at which we were cutting trees for Christmas alone would eventually destroy our great forest, and so he banned the Christmas tree from his home and urged everyone to do the same. Happily for the Roosevelt children, Teddy's sister Banny had a mind of her own. She gave a Christmas tree party for her nieces and nephews, and the whole first family spent Christmas Day at her house. The following year, however, the president was embarrassed to find that two of his boys, Archie and Quentin, had smuggled a tree into the closet in Archie's room. Teddy described his Christmas and the unexpected breach of conduct in a letter. Yesterday morning at 7:15, all the children were up and dressed and began to hammer at the door of their mother's and my room, in which their six stockings, all bulging out with queer angles and rotundities, were hanging from the fireplace. So their mother and I got up, shut the window, lit the fire, taking down the stockings, of course, put on our wrappers, and prepared to admit the children. But first, there was a surprise for me, also for their good mother,
for Archie had a little Christmas tree of his own which he had rigged up with the help of one of the carpenters in a big closet, and we all had to look at the tree and each of us got a present off of it. After a lecture, Roosevelt sent the two boys to call on his friend and cabinet member, Gifford Pinchot. Pinchot was the foremost conservationist in the country, and Teddy must have been dumbfounded when, instead of espousing a hard line, Pinchot told them to tell their father that, properly handled, the cutting of Christmas trees could be an asset in helping to thin the timberlands. This was the first of many times Pinchot and the National Forest Service would defend the Christmas tree against its critics. Officially, the White House continued each Christmas to state that there would be no presidential tree. However, secretly, Archie was allowed each year thereafter to put up a small tree in his own room. In 1906, a man from New York State, feeling sorry for the Roosevelt children, sent them a Christmas tree together with a box of ornaments. The gift was summarily returned with a letter stating that the children of the president were not allowed to accept presents from people they did not know. The frequent pre-Christmas shortage of trees in New York City had become acute by 1905, and in mid-December dealers were reported to be at their wits' end trying to get even 70% of their orders filled. 2 years later came the worst shortage so far. 68,000 fewer trees than usual made their way to the New York market. Editorials and letters urged that only people with children should have trees, and wherever possible they should be artificial. Artificial trees of various sizes had been advertised since at least 1901. The debate grew fierce. Supporters of Christmas trees pointed out that the best-shaped ones didn't come from the beleaguered forests, but grew along fence lines and in pastures and other open spots. And furthermore, the firs that made the best trees would, if left to grow, never be good for lumber anyway. In 1909, the Forest Service estimated that 5 million Christmas trees were cut and that one American family in every four had a tree in its home. Gifford Pinchot continued to say that forest fires and not Christmas tree cutters were the threats that must be checked. He urged reforestation and estimated that the young evergreens then being cut in America for Christmas could all be grown on 1,500 acres if planted 4 feet apart. He explained that evergreens grow quite rapidly, approximately 1 foot per year. But the Christmas tree critics, encouraged by the ever-present shortages, were more vocal every year, and they got a lot of editorial support. The Ladies' Home Journal, in its December 1900 issue, gave its readers a decorating idea to replace a Christmas tree, calling the object a Jacob's Ladder and billing it as an inexpensive substitute. The magazine showed its readers how to cover a stepladder with cheesecloth and greens and candles. Presents were to be arranged on the steps. By the 1920s, the conservationists were in full voice with a well-organized campaign. The Christmas tree trade finally realized that they were bringing a lot of criticism on themselves by cutting only the trees that were the easiest to get to market. They were buying the rights to evergreens along the roadsides and then felling every tree in sight. Each fall, Americans were exposed to battle-scarred landscapes, and one can hardly blame a 1920s motorist for getting a false impression about what was happening to our forests. The cutters began to thin rather than to level the trees along the highways, and sound conservation practices became more prevalent. By 1920, 5 million Christmas trees were being exported from Vermont alone. They came mostly from the Green Mountains, where abandoned farms were returning naturally to timberland. Trees in Vermont forest grew too close together to develop good full shapes. Every railroad siding in that part of Vermont was loaded with trees brought down mostly by horses and wagons, since the winter roads were too bad to be practical for the trucks of that day. At the same time, Christmas tree cultivation became a profitable business in many parts of the country. Farmers began to find it a good way to use rocky upland pastures and pieces of land not suited to other farming. In the 1930s, Franklin D. Roosevelt was the country's best-known Christmas tree farmer. He helped popularize the concept by growing Christmas trees on his estate at Hyde Park, New York. In the Depression years, a new type of Christmas tree made its debut in America. Scotch pine farming began as a gleam in the eye of Fred Musser of Indiana, Pennsylvania. Musser was a born salesman. In 1934, he won a National Dealer Prize selling Chryslers. 6 years before, in 1928, he came up with an idea that by 1942 had made him rich and interesting enough to be written up in Fortune magazine. Musser decided that if he planted evergreens on cheap, abandoned western Pennsylvania farms, he could sell them in 5 or 6 years as Christmas trees. Long-needled pines had never been sold as Christmas trees, but Musser believed they could be. He knew that they would be more difficult to decorate than trees with short needles. On the other hand, he pointed out, whereas balsams and spruces start dropping their needles practically the minute they feel the axe, cut Scotch pines will keep their needles almost all winter. Housewives, he argued, would like that enough to offset the difficulty of decorating. And dealers would like it. They could buy early, sell early, and take no loss from dried-out trees. He talked his father, other relatives, and friends into investing in his idea, and he planted his first seedlings. In 1930, Musser made his first big market test. He cut Scotch pines already on the land, loaded 11 railroad cars, and shipped them all to one dealer in Buffalo, New York, on consignment. He calculated that the trees were worth $1,000 per car wholesale, but got only $198 for all 11 cars. Fred Musser remained undismayed. "We've got a lot more missionary work to do with this product," he told his partners. He continued to ship his pines on consignment, and under his prodding, markets gradually opened up in Chicago, St. Louis, Cleveland, and Philadelphia. Though to this day, New York and New England remain committed to conventional balsams, firs, and spruces. A blight that attacked millions of balsams in the Maine woods in the 1930s created economic hardship for many in the business and led to importation of Christmas trees from Canada. In the 1960s, the biggest selling tree in America was the Douglas fir, known in the Christmas business as Montana fir. It is an unusually thick, soft, short-needled evergreen. When cut, it holds its short needles longer in our heated homes than other short-needled trees. To supply the demand for long-lasting Douglas firs, Montana suppliers harvest their trees year-round and refrigerate them. Cold storage warehousing also allows Minnesota suppliers to cut trees almost all year long. Early in the 1970s, Fred Musser's long-needled Scotch pine edged out the Douglas fir to become the most popular tree taken home for Christmas. In Nebraska, the United States Forest Service and the University of Nebraska are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in a controlled 20-year experiment in pursuit of the perfectly shaped, pedigreed Scotch pine. No matter what the species or how perfect the shape, or how many millions are sold each year, Christmas trees are still cut and sold and selected by eager families in a business that Mark Carr could feel pretty much at home with if he were to come back today.
Round and round the Christmas tree,
opening presents with the family.
One for me
and two for me. Oh, what a Christmas day.
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 We hope you enjoyed the 2014 Sight into Sound Christmas Special. An American Christmas, a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas. Your producer was Jim Martinez. I'm Jim Seitz. On behalf of the staff and volunteers at Sight into Sound, we would like to wish you a very Merry Christmas.